Ezra, Dave, and Drew return on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Halfway through the Saturday edition of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, Drew Mandel and Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
From NHL.com, a very good friend of the program, we're pleased to welcome back Tim Campbell. Tim, good morning. How are things?
Things are great. How are things with you guys today?
And things are fantastic. We're in a windowless studio. What could be better?
I'm very tired, Tim.
Tim, obviously, talk a little bit around the NHL. We start, of course, here with the Winnipeg Jets. And, you know, we spent much of the first 90 minutes of this morning's program talking about the Jets and what their off-season priorities should be. And we've been debating and we've been analyzing. From your perspective, Tim, if you had to rank, you know, your top off-season priorities for the Winnipeg Jets, would it be a goaltender or would it be upgrading the defense?
I think it would be a goaltender. And, you know, in so many ways, that's the thread that has caused so much stress, I think, in Winnipeg this year. And I don't want to lay it all at, you know, the feet of mainly Connor Hellebuck. But when you have the inconsistency and the struggles, and I think at times the overwork, because, you know, 10, 12, 15, 20 straight starts is generally too much for any one goalie to bear when your team is not the Chicago Blackhawks or the Washington Capitals of today. You know, it just leads to so many other things. You get a goalie who has to start that many games, and then he maybe has I'm not saying a bad day, but let's say he's just not feeling great. Maybe he's getting over the flu or something in a given week of the season. But, you know, the fans don't see that and probably don't care. And yet he has to come in there and perform, you know, exceptionally well, and he maybe doesn't have his A stuff on a given night, so the result isn't good. So now it carries over into thinking, well, maybe I should have done this, maybe I should have done that, maybe I should have told the coach I shouldn't have played. And the doubt begins, and that's how the snowball gets going in my view. It's why you can't just flip a switch and turn this on or off it. Game 51 when the level of the game gets better and it's crunch time for the season. So retracing back to the beginning, I mean, if you have a little more stability and experience in goal with other options, maybe things could be different. So whether it's to find a quality backup goalie of some veteran experience who could help and mentor Hellebuck along, or find a true number one who's going to play 55 or 60 games for you next year, and maybe the year after, until Connor and Eric Comrie are ready to play as full-time goalies, I think that's the most realistic option. Now, finding somebody like that, I don't think is going to be any easy chore. There's competition out there with some other teams who are looking for goaltending, and as you guys well know, Winnipeg is not the most popular destination for many, many NHL players. And believe me, I'm the biggest Winnipeg advocate there is. But realism tells me that, you know, 95% of players with a no-trade clause have Winnipeg on their list, and free agents just don't see it as a good place to play. Now, it's not saying there isn't going to be some goalie out there that looks at the situation a little more carefully, apart from the weather and the geography, and says, wow, you know, you got to like some of the talent that's going on there, and this would be a great opportunity. There might be someone out there that sees it as a win-win. You got to hope you can find somebody like that. But for me, that's the priority, and that's why I would make it the priority.
Tim, I'm not sure if you caught any of Hustler and Lawless yesterday. A big topic on HNL was discipline and the penalty kill, and the Jets are, again, one of the most penalized teams in the league, and they have the second-worst PK if a coaching change isn't coming with Paul Maurice, how does he get through to these guys to get them to stay out of the box more?
Well, I'm pretty sure there's no coaching change coming, despite what, you know, a long list of experts seem to think needs to happen. So it's either time for maybe a new assistant or two, or a new system or two, or you might find a good player that could help you that way. I think Sean Matthias has probably been a help to their penalty killing. In my view, he has, but he's been hurt so much that, again, we have inconsistencies. We have other players that go in to do that role and don't do it the same. And if you have the same plan, but you can't get it executed, then you're probably needing plan B, C, and on down the line. It's clearly a problem. I think the discipline is more the problem than the actual scheme of penalty killing. And the Jets have been, apart from the lockout season, appalling, in my view, in the way they've killed penalties. I mean, it steals so much momentum from your game. On even if it's 5 out of every 10 games where you can't do it right, it steals away so much momentum from every game you play. You have to be extraordinarily good to overcome that. And even if it's only 5 out of every 10 games, I mean, you put yourself behind the eight ball in that number of games in every segment, you know, the chances are you're going to lose those games. So you're already starting from behind if you can't kill penalties. Some of the things that I don't tell me if you guys agree with me or not, but some of the things I still see when I watch games, the careless sticks and you know, the unnecessary roughness. I understand the game's emotional, but more control is clearly required. I'm amazed at how many stick fouls the Jets keep coming up with. They talk about it. It gets better for a week, and then it just goes back to being what it always has. And I really am not sure how you ungrain an ingrain thing like that, but in today's NHL, where every sticky little clip of the helmet by a stick is, you know, causes someone's head to snap back, I mean, you have to know after so many times being burned, this is the way it is. You would modify your behavior, and I'm at a loss to explain why it can't be modified. And it's clearly way worse a problem than the actual penalty killing. Because in my view, if the Jets took 20% less penalties, they would kill a lot more off. I know that doesn't sort of jive together with the math, but when you're in the box less and worried about it less, you'd probably do a better job thinking you could kill off 2 or 3 a night as opposed to having to kill off 4, 5, or 6 sometimes a night.
Some would say, Tim, that the Jets are such slow learners when it comes to penalty killing or taking penalties that there's a future ahead with them here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. But that's a separate issue altogether. Tim Campbell of NHL.com joins us on the line. You know, Tim, we are and another one of the topics we are talking about is sort of the front office makeup of the Winnipeg Jets. I tend to agree that I don't think Kevin Cheveldayoff or Paul Maurice are going away anywhere this offseason, or maybe not anytime soon. But from my perspective, I look at the Calgary Flames, where you have a rookie general manager in Brad Treliving, and he has a sounding board in Brian Burke. And you have sort of the reverse in Toronto, where you have a rookie president of hockey operations in Brendan Shanahan, and he has a sounding board and a veteran general manager in Lou Lamoriello. Here in Winnipeg, it's Kevin Cheveldayoff, and there's nobody above him except for really Mark Chipman in the role of an ownership. What are your thoughts on sort of adding another layer to the front office here in Winnipeg, and, you know, maybe providing a veteran voice for Kevin Cheveldayoff to consult with in the course of an off season and a regular season?
I think that's wishful thinking. I think the money would be way better spent on a goalie. I understand that there's been, I mean, I read and watch, and I've been in Winnipeg quite a number of times this season that I read and watch what's going on. I mean, the examination of every nook and cranny now of the Jets team and the organization, I mean, it's understandable, but I really think that the angst that seems to be bubbling up again here, and I think it was bubbling quite thoroughly last year before the draft lottery, which seemed to calm things down for about maybe only 6 months. I really think it's all a bit hasty. I understand the frustration of a lot of fans, but You know, given the parameters that the Jets and Kevin Cheveldayoff in particular and his management team and all the scouts have to work with, and that's that trades are almost impossible to make, and free agency is really not a saving road. It isn't for any team anymore, really. But when you're desperate, sometimes you can go out and find what you need. But I don't think it's that easy for the Jets due to all the things we talked about in the last question. You know, I'm sort of rambling here, but they put in place a plan that they think can steer around these obstacles and these handicaps, and that's to build through the draft and build an organization from bottom to top, which at the beginning of 2011-2012 was probably very close to zero in terms of depth. There were some serviceable players, a couple of good players, and you know, the process has begun. We've seen some results of that process in people like Jacob Trouba and Nick Ehlers, and in particular Mark Scheifele. And I would suggest Josh Morrissey is probably a good addition to that list this year. And even Adam Lowry has been a pretty fine draft pick. I mean, these are not first overall picks or the slam dunk picks that are easy to make, but they've made some good ones and they've begun the building process. But it's not a short process. And in my view, the team is only partway through the program, and especially because when they made the playoffs two springs ago, that happy time in Winnipeg, that people shouldn't take their eye off. A lot of folks, in my opinion, look at it wrong. That the Jets, there was great euphoria around the team and the enthusiasm of a building team. But to get to the playoffs and not win a game, I don't think was very fulfilling for the fans. I read something the other day, I can't remember where it was, that tried to actually, you know, paint it in a different way. Well, the Jets got swept, but hey, the analytics of that series were really, really close. And so somehow as a fan, I'm supposed to feel good about that and trying to use that sort of against the Jets that they made a mistake. I think the decision was quite clear whether they declared it you know, from the rooftops or not, but the decisions that followed that playoff series were quite clear that that wasn't going to be good enough, and that's certainly not what the Jets strive for. Certainly didn't want that for their fans. So they decided to go young and rebuild and build it up a different way. And so they got younger, and they didn't go out and tell people they were going to get worse, but they said, sweep in the first round and just getting there. That's not what we're after here. We want to be a contending team. We want to be a better team. We want to be a factor. And so there's some more short-term pain here. And it's not the same as the pain of 1996. It's a frustrating pain because you believe you were in the playoffs, that you should be in the playoffs. But to me, that expectation is totally wrong. But a lot of people have used that expectation as the baseline now for declaring the last two seasons an utter failure and calling for the GM's head and the coach's head. I think a lot of experts have gotten this wrong by being unable to admit that their expectations have been wrong about this team. I still see as a team on the way up. It may not be next season again. I can't say for sure, but this is a team that's stockpiling talent. It's building through the draft. You ask any of the other 29 general managers how to build a team now, 10 years into the salary cap era, what they've learned. And nobody's going to tell you that free agency is the way to go anymore. Nobody does that anymore. Everyone's drafting or is draft-focused, and they've added to their scouting departments, and they've added to this build-up phase of the teams. I mean, even the Leafs, for heaven's sakes, after 9 years of not figuring it out, have figured it out. And what you see on the ice in Toronto these days is quite a bit a product of how to go about it differently and how to go about it in the modern era. The Jets have been doing that for, you know, since they came back to Winnipeg. So back to your original question, do the Jets need a president of hockey operations or a Brian Burke character? I don't really think they do. I think if they had a goalie and maybe some kind of adjustment defensively, I think things would be a lot different. We'd be having a lot different conversations here, let's say this time next season, if you guys are happy enough to call me up and ask me some questions at the end of March next year. If they had a goalie, I think these conversations would be quite different.
We're going to keep calling. The question is, are you going to answer? That's always what we're afraid of there, Tim.
Tim, we've got one last question for you here. Moving away from the Jets, you've watched the Edmonton Oilers there quite a bit this year in the City of Champions. And when you look at where the Oilers are right now, they can end up even winning the Pacific Division and getting to that 100-point mark this year. They're at 89 points right now. How amazed are you how far the Edmonton Oilers have come? Because when you look at where they were last year, they were a pretty bad team. But this year, they're going to make the playoffs. But not only are they going to make the playoffs, they might end up winning a round. And it's obviously led by Connor McDavid, who's up to 87 points now. Cam Talbot's already played 60-plus games. Just how impressed have you been with how far this team has come in their development?
Well, I have been impressed. That's a good word. Surprised, I am not. I'll share something with you guys. I mean, over the past, six seasons since we got really interested in the NHL with the return of the Jets. I mean, I've watched the Oilers closely, and I think, personally with my friends and others, I've been probably fairly critical of the Oilers and almost dismissive in their unwillingness to form a team as opposed to just draft the best player at number one and number two all the time. That you can go on doing that and great, but until you can put a team together, you're not going to get anywhere. So I think I've always been kind of dismissive of the Oilers because they refuse to make any of those moves, that they continually overvalued the players they had to form a team, and then they wouldn't make any trades. And there was always talk, yes, we'll do that, this and that. And I guess it sounds a bit harsh on the former management group, but they made some changes here. And finally, I think they've figured out with Pete Chiarelli how to build a team. They've drafted pretty good. I mean, they have some pretty good players through the draft, but two things, and this goes back to what I was talking about with you guys in the earlier questions. I mean, what's happened with the Oilers this year? Why have they made this jump? Okay, yes, they have Connor McDavid. He's an unbelievably good player. But two really important things have happened in Edmonton. They went and found a goalie. And the dividends of that move, which was 2 years ago by getting Cam Talbot, the dividends of that move now are seeing the light of day with this season. I mean, they've probably overplayed him, but he's a pretty fine athlete, and their schedule, especially recently, has been very conducive to continue to play him. He's played the most goal of any goalie in the NHL, and he's been excellent this year. He's a good number one goalie, probably doesn't get as much credit for what's happened in Edmonton as he should. And there you have it. With some goaltending now, the Oilers have a chance. And then they did one other really important thing, which was last offseason they realized they were spinning their wheels with a lot of good forwards, and that they decided finally to part with one of them for something they really needed, which was a defenseman, a real serviceable defenseman. And that was Adam Larson. The trade was very unpopular here in Edmonton. Taylor Hall for Adam Larson last summer. I think if you walked around the streets and went up to anybody, let's say at tonight's game against Colorado, and asked them again to revisit this trade, what they'd say, I think you'd find a complete reversal. I don't think you'd find 10% of people that would want this trade back. I mean, Adam Larson is not an all-star, but he's a very tough, good skating, stay-at-home defenseman who knows how to play defense, and he's in your face, and he can make a good first pass. I mean, in his addition and the signing of Chris Russell in free agency now, adding two really honest, serviceable, functioning NHL defensemen has made a humongous difference for the Oilers. They now have, in my opinion, 10 to 12 less fire drills in their own end every game. And now that time is spent in the neutral zone or in the offensive zone. And look at what's happened. They have a good goalie. They have a functioning defense. It doesn't have any all-stars, but it's a functioning defense with Andre Sekera and Oscar Klefbom being the other two, bona fide NHL players on the back end. And now look what's happened here. They have enough offense and skill to win games. They can bring McDavid at you. They can bring Nugent Hopkins at you. They have some great utility players like Mark Letestu. They have a good budding star in Patrick Maroon. And their offensive tools now are suddenly more effective because they aren't a disaster in their own end, and they have a good goalie. Does that sound familiar to you guys?
It sounds a little familiar there, Tim.
So if you need a clue as to what maybe should or needs to happen in another Western Canadian NHL city, I think Edmonton's a pretty good example.
And Tim, Darnell Nurse has missed half of the year, but he's also had a nice year.
And there you go. I mean, here's a player that's missed half the year. He was a rookie last year. And is he on the third pairing for the rest of his life? I would say not. But they've got him in a pretty good place here now where he can learn the game a little better. He's sort of a younger Adam Larson, in my view, in many ways. I don't think he's a big offensive guy, but he's going to be really hard to play against. He's a big person, too.
Tim Campbell covers the Edmonton Oilers. He covers the Winnipeg Jets. He covers the world of hockey for NHL.com. He's a good friend of this program. Tim, always appreciate your time and your insight. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Have a great weekend, guys.
Likewise, Tim. Take care.
Cheers, Tim.
When we come back, what are we going to do? We'll talk about the Jets and the Canucks when we come back. How about that? And then we'll talk about Sidney Crosby in the last hour. Matt Laughlin, New Jersey Devils broadcaster, joins us at the top of the hour. And Adrian Dater joins us, looking back 20 years since the insane Red Wings Avalanche brawl. That's all coming up in the last hour. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show returns. Now you're on the curve on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Five minutes before the top of the hour, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Coming up at the top of the hour, Matt Laughlin, New Jersey Devils play-by-play broadcaster, joins us. The Jets and the Devils will meet on Tuesday night, the makeup game that was postponed. What was that? Was that just last week? It seems like it was about a month ago. I guess it was just last week or so. So that makeup game's coming up on Tuesday. We'll talk to Matt about the Devils, interesting team in that they acquired Taylor Hall. Their season hasn't gone as intended. We don't talk a ton about the Devils. I know that you'd like to talk probably about what? You'd enjoy a solid 10 out of 12 segments a week on the Devils, given your Devils fandom?
Well, they've had a horrible year, and really, there isn't really one area of the team that has been great, right? Corey Schneider's had a rough year. They just don't get enough scoring. That defense, to me, needs a lot of work. After Andy Green and after Damon Severson, you don't have a lot there, right? So there isn't too much positive news coming out of New Jersey, but this game is going to be one of those games that doesn't have any playoff implications. No. You kind of wonder why they're even going to play it.
I asked that when they rescheduled it. I wasn't sure what was the need to even reschedule this game, because it certainly won't have any playoff implications whatsoever. Of course, before that, the Jets and the Canucks will do battle tomorrow night at MTS Center. Game, of course, you can hear live on TSN 1290. Vancouver announced this morning they signed Brock Besser to a two-year entry-level contract. He, of course, played for the North Dakota Fighting Hawks. They were eliminated in the NCAA playoffs last night.
Yeah, went to overtime.
Went to overtime. They were eliminated. Brock Besser signs with the Canucks, will play tonight for Vancouver, or this afternoon, rather, as the Canucks, I believe, are in Minnesota to meet the Wild. The interesting part of that isn't, less so about Brock Besser.
Tucker Pullman. Yeah.
That's the question, because you saw the UND season end. Brock Besser signs the next day, the next morning. Makes you wonder about Tucker Pullman and when and if we will be hearing any news with regard to Tucker Pullman and the Winnipeg Jets, because, of course, the Jets are hoping to get him under contract as a draft pick. Otherwise, he can hit unrestricted free agency later on this summer.
Right, and Tucker Pullman's injured right now.
Right.
So we don't know if he's an option to play.
I don't even think the Jets care if he plays or not. They just want his name on
paper. Well, I'm
just
saying, you saw Brock Besser play, so there's always the chance that you maybe get Tucker Pullman into a game or two, but that obviously depends on his health. But I expect Tucker Pullman to sign with the Jets. He's played 3 years at the University of North Dakota now. But Brock Besser, I actually saw him play last year. He scored a hat trick the first game of the season for UND. Really good player. But when you're talking about the Canucks, Drew, they're exactly where I thought they would be. That's one team that I was right about this year. I've been wrong about many teams this year, but that Vancouver Canucks team, we kind of wondered why they went out and signed a guy like Louis Erickson.
Yeah.
After the Sedins and after Louis Erickson, Bo Horvat's had a nice season, and Troy Stetcher's been a nice story, speaking of guys that used to play for UND.
Yeah.
But, Brian Miller's, held the fort down there. But this Canucks team is obviously in a rebuild now. We saw that at the trade deadline.
Finally, they acknowledge that.
Well, Yannick Hansen gets shipped out to San Jose, and
Burrows goes to Ottawa.
So, I mean, it's a rebuild here. The Canucks are not going to have good teams here for the next 2 or 3 years. But again, you look at teams like Toronto and Edmonton; they've been able to turn it around. Drafting is going to be very important for this Canucks team, right? They're going to get a fairly high draft pick this year. It's going to be a top 10 draft pick. We don't know exactly where it's going to be, but that's going to be really important. And you've got some other players coming up through the system, right, for the Vancouver Canucks. Mm-hmm. But Brock Besser is a big part of that. So I would imagine that not only is he going to play a few games here to end the season, but I imagine he's going to be a full-time NHLer next year.
Oh, I would think so. I think that's just he was waiting for his season to end.
Like, he's not going to be a guy that has to spend time in the American Hockey League unless he really struggles. But from what I've seen of Brock Besser, he's the real deal.
He certainly isn't an 18-year-old rookie at this point in time. He's probably ready to step in. And the Canucks need all the young talent they can get as they're going through their rebuild. Want to make a note about the Bruins and the Islanders game tonight. We talked about how significant the playoff implications are for that game, both those teams battling for the final Eastern Conference playoff spots. No Tuukka Rask for the Bruins, lower body injury, so that he will not be in the Bruins lineup tonight, which is a huge blow, of course, to the Bruins looking to end a 4-game losing streak, get back above the playoff line as they do battle with the New York Islanders later on this evening. Both those teams tied with 82 points. The Islanders a game in hand, the Bruins with the tiebreaker. Almost a must-win for the Bruins in that they have to end this losing streak before it gets too carried away, before it reaches 5 games. So no Tuukka Rask tonight for the Boston Bruins.
Yeah, and Anton Khudobin hasn't played much this year, and he hasn't been great. So he's going to get the start versus the Islanders. And do you go back with Jaro Halak? Picked up the win after being recalled from the American Hockey League, right?
Yeah.
This is bizarro year for the New York Islanders, right?
Yeah.
In every sense of the word. Their arena is basically...
a basketball arena.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, you know, the ice has probably been the worst in the NHL, but, you know, you fire your coach, you send Halak down to the American Hockey League, and then now you're in the playoff spot, and then you've got Halak back in the NHL, so...
Hey, they're in the playoff spot right now. That's all that matters.
It's true.
Two teams that aren't are the Winnipeg Jets and the New Jersey Devils. Matt Laughlin is the New Jersey Devils play-by-play broadcaster. He joins us next on the show. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Curve on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Hour number three of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Pleased to welcome back to the program Matt Laughlin. He's a good friend of ours. He's the New Jersey Devils radio broadcaster on WFAN. The Jets and the Devils will do battle, at least as much as two non-playoff teams can do battle in the final couple weeks of the season on Tuesday night, a makeup game for the game that was postponed a couple weeks ago. Matt, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Drew, Ezra, thanks very much for having me. Always a pleasure to speak with you guys.
This pleasure is all ours, Matt. You know, obviously a bit of a disappointing season for the Devils in that they are clearly not going to make the playoffs. They're the bottom team in the Eastern Conference. I don't know that many people who had the Devils as a playoff team, but even so, is this performance, you know, disappointing to the organization? Did they think they'd be more, you know, on the cusp of a playoff spot than being one of the bottom feeders in the entire NHL?
I think they felt that they would at least be battling down the stretch, if not realistically. Like, for instance, Carolina is knocking on the door, but really 5 points out in the final 2 weeks with teams to climb over. Is it realistic? But there's hope there for Carolina. So I think the Devils thought that they would be in that position, and especially off a great start. They went 9-3-3 to begin the year and then hit the skids off a Western road trip and just never fully recovered. So, yes, I think based on where they were at the beginning of the year, what their hopes were, bringing in Taylor Hall, bringing some veterans in to fill in some spots, which they thought would result in a few more goals, they are disappointed. However, I think at a certain point they realized they had to turn the corner, and so they didn't stay down that path, and so they removed those veterans by trading them. They brought up a lot of their younger players from Albany who are getting a chance now to prove to the coaching staff and management whether or not they have a role moving forward. So rather than kind of fighting through this till the very end, till the bitter end, and then finding out about some of these young kids next year in camp, which is not necessarily the best experiment because you don't play against the full lineup, but having them play here against the Rangers, against Pittsburgh, against Philadelphia, against a Winnipeg team that can bring some offense, things like that will show who could be part of the solution moving forward. So that's what they decided to do. So from that standpoint, it's kind of like they pulled the Band-Aid, you know, off, let some air in on the wound, and now it's moving forward.
Matt, Winnipeg hockey fans are really familiar with Corey Schneider. He played a couple years with the Manitoba Moose. They actually went to an AHL final 1 year with Corey Schneider in net. This is now his fourth year with the Devils, and we talked about how much the Devils have been struggling. His save percentage is .911 after his save percentage was in between .924 and .925 the last couple of years. How concerned is the team with his play this year? He's under contract for five more years. I would imagine they're not that concerned considering that the defense in front of him has struggled a lot too.
Not concerned because they have faith that Corey will return to form. But if he was part of this conversation, he would echo the thoughts of everyone involved with the Devils. He would admit that his play has not been good enough this year. Now, yes, there have been some reasons. The Devils' defense took a little bit of a step back, particularly earlier in the season when they started to hit the skids. You know, they were giving up far too many goals. But as you know, the life of a goaltender is there's a critical moment in a game where the save has to be made, regardless of whether it's a two-on-one against or regardless of whether it's a tricky hop. The goalie will want to make that save, will need to make that save, and that didn't happen on a regular enough basis this year for Corey, and he knows that, and he knows that going into next year, he'll want to bounce back, need to bounce back, but I think he has certainly confidence in himself, and the organization has belief that he can be that guy. So, it's a one-year, in my mind, and I think in everyone's mind, a one-year aberration. But he needs to be able to return to form if the Devils are to take steps forward next year.
Matt Laughlin, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Matt covers the New Jersey Devils. He's their play-by-play broadcaster on WFAN Radio. Matt, the big offseason acquisition, of course, for the Devils was Taylor Hall. He's had a bit of an up-and-down year. He's had some injury troubles a little bit. He's got 49 points in 63 games. How would you assess, if you had to give a grade to Taylor Hall's season, what would you grade him as?
Right now, I would say it's a B, maybe a B minus, and I would say that the injury played a role in that. He didn't miss that many games because of it, but I think the effects of that knee injury lingered for a long time. So I think the expectations were that he would be more offensive than he's been this year. Part of that is a product of who he had been playing with. Now he settled in nicely on the left wing of Travis Ajak and Kyle Palmieri. On the other hand, he's been the Devils' best player. He's the most gifted player on the team. Each night he makes a move that says, wow, you know, brings you out of your seat. It hasn't resulted in a goal. So maybe I'm being a little harsh by even hinting at a B minus. I would say a solid B. He's among the leading scorers. He's out there, playing a lot of minutes each night. I think he would want to do a little bit more. I think moving, even though it was a losing situation in Edmonton, but he had spent a lot of time there, moving to the East Coast, new organization, a lot of expectations, which he's used to, but now it's still a little different. You're going to come and be our guy. We traded a young, up-and-coming defenseman for you, a trade that we would make all the time because of your skill, and now dazzle us. And I think that's a lot of pressure, and you know whether or not we should expect him to push through that pressure and perform despite it. I don't know. He's still a young kid. I think next year will be better because he'll be more comfortable. The environment will be different. And I think the Taylor Hall the Devils wanted to acquire will be on display. Again, that being said, he's been the best. He has the most talent offensively on the team without question.
Matt, for Devils general manager Ray Shiro, how big of a priority is re-signing Damon Severson?
Well, Damon certainly is a big part of this team's future. There's no question. Whenever anyone talks about where the Devils are going next year, who will be foundation pieces, his name comes up. So, you know, it's a matter of each side agreeing and coming up with the terms that are acceptable to both. But he's their leading scorer among defensemen. He hasn't scored a goal in, you know, a dog's year. It's back to November. But he still is out there, you know, leading way out in front of the pack and has a very high ceiling. His consistency needs to improve. The Devils are working hard on that. They know that there is a lot there still. So, yeah, he's a critical part moving forward.
Matt Laughlin, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Matt is the radio broadcaster for the New Jersey Devils on WFAN Radio. Matt, Kyle Palmieri, 25 goals of the season. Last year he had 30, so he's certainly in range of where he was last season. When the Devils brought him over from Anaheim. Previously in Anaheim, you know, a 14-goal guy, that was his career high. Obviously, he's taken that next step. Is it a function of the opportunity he's getting in New Jersey that allows him to get into the 25-30-goal range as opposed to the opportunity that was afforded him in Anaheim? Or is his game really developed into that next level where, you know, 30-goal scorers don't grow on trees in this day and age in the NHL?
No, certainly they don't. I think it's a byproduct of both. Certainly he's getting more time. He's being put out in all critical situations, which he was not getting in Anaheim because of the players who are ahead of him on the depth chart. So getting more time gives him an opportunity to produce more, and then your confidence grows. I think in Anaheim, you know, many times it looked like he would get a chance, and then Teemu Selanne would decide to come back, and okay, there goes the chance. I'm not going to see that much time. And I think bouncing back and forth, it's hard to keep your confidence high. So finally he comes to New Jersey, and they say, look, you're going to be out there all the time. You're going to be playing 18 minutes a night. Go for it. And so I think that and just, you know, some personal growth and his confidence has all played a role. And I think now, you know, we didn't see it at the beginning of the year, but he's such a bulldog player. And that was a big part of his game last year. That was the player they acquired from Anaheim, a guy who was hard to play against, a guy who was competitive. The Devils need to increase their compete level across the board, and they got that guy. And then this year, not that he wasn't competing, but it just wasn't the same player. Finally, for whatever reason, he settled down and he's taken off. And as you mentioned, 25 goals, and he leads the Devils in scoring.
Matt, Devils rookie forward Pavel Zacha, he was taken sixth overall back in 2015. This is his first full-time year in the NHL. What have you liked about his game? How would you assess his first full year in the NHL?
Very much a growing year for him. Earlier in the year, he seemed, I hate to use the word overwhelmed, but it was a new world for him. He's got very good skill. He can skate, he's got size, he can compete. But he's not Connor McDavid. You know, he's not on that level. So as a 19-year-old, he came in out of playing for Sarnia last year, and it was, wow, this is the National Hockey League. Everything happens quickly. It didn't happen quickly for him. And then, again, confidence declined. He gets scratched a bit. But he finally got the message, and he understands. And it was really just with experience. So he's played better and better. He's skating more. He handles the puck. He's making smart decisions. He's going to be a very good player in this league. Again, he won't be one of the all-time greats. That's not in his toolbox, but he can be a 15, 17-year player in this league that can score 20 to 25 goals, no question.
You know, Matt, you've covered the Devils for many years, and wanted to ask you about a fellow Czech Republic countryman, Patrick Eliáš. He hasn't played since the 2015-16, hasn't played any games this year. Are we expecting that Patrick is going to announce his retirement shortly?
I would anticipate that, yes. He joined us on a pregame show in early February, and what he said was, because he had been skating and had been working with the staff, never skating with the team, but in early and had, you know, full opportunity to use our training staff and our strength and conditioning guys. The all-time leading scorer deserves at least that consideration from his organization. And so he would say that he would have times where he didn't think the knee could handle the workload, and then suddenly he hit a spurt where he felt it could. And he thought at that time that physically, if he kept at it, he might be able to return from that side of the game. However, he said, being away from the game, spending some more time at home, life started to intrude in a very good way. And he said he's not sure that emotionally he can make the commitment. And he did admit once you reach that point, he goes, you can't play in the best league in the world. You can't just go through the motions. And he has now, well, I'd say in the last 2 months, he's only skated a handful of times. So it pretty much appeared then that he was at peace with his decision. He wasn't ready to announce it. He hasn't announced it since. But his actions since, in terms of not really skating as much as he once did, and his words then certainly point to an announcement forthcoming at some point.
Well, Matt, if it is the end of his career, I mean, it was an amazing career, and I think there's something to be said for playing your entire career with one organization. And at the end of the day, you know, he retires with two Stanley Cup rings, and I would say he should be a Hall of Famer.
You know, one of the rare players anymore that spends his entire career with the team. Absolutely. He was a brilliant performer, all-time leading scorer for the team. You mentioned the Cups, the way he handled himself, the artistry he brought to the game. Yeah, you know, I think he is a Hall of Famer. I think that the voters have to also take into consideration that there were times in his career when the Devils weren't as offensive-minded. They had many years. If you look back at their championship year in 2000, or the year after when they went to the final, they were scoring a lot of goals. They were an offensive team known still as a trap team, but people overlooked the fact that they were potting goals on a regular basis. But there were times in his career when they were more defensive-oriented, and that locked down his numbers a little bit. You know, never had a 100-point season. I could see why some people might say, yeah, close but no cigar, but having seen him throughout his career, what he brought night in and night out, I think he deserves a spot in Toronto for sure.
Matt, we'll let you go with this last question. Obviously, Tuesday's game between the Jets and the Devils is a makeup game from the game a couple weeks ago that was snowed out. It's the 20th anniversary of the 334 Club, the famous game in 87 between the Devils and the Flames, where only 334 people could attend the game due to the weather. Was there any thought that maybe they would just let that game go, you know, the game that was snowed out, let it just occur in front of whoever could attend rather than trying to shoehorn this into the schedule?
Well, I think there was some consideration made. I think that there were some fans who thought that that would be very cool, that they either weren't alive or couldn't get to that game back in the day, and that they would become a part of the new club. But in the end, there was a state of emergency that was declared here in the state. And even though, yes, Winnipeg was here already, and obviously the Devils nearby, the officials were in, and generally the league says let's go, there was a state of emergency. A lot of the workers in the building take mass transit, New Jersey Transit, which is the mass transit operator in the state, canceled bus services, not train services, but bus services. A lot of our workers take the bus. It would have been a hardship to ask them to do that. And so in the end, even though it's a little crazy that Winnipeg's got to be home and come in for a one-off and go back, it probably was the smart decision. But yeah, it would have been interesting to see how many people had shown up that night and what kind of an intimate setting we would have had for that game.
Matt Lachlan is the Devils radio broadcaster on WFAN. Matt, always appreciate your time. Always enjoy chatting with you. Enjoy the game on Tuesday night, of course. Have a great call. We'll see you in Winnipeg next season.
You got it, guys. Thanks very much. Always appreciate the time with you.
Take care, Matt. When we come back, we discuss Sidney Crosby versus Mark Methot versus
his finger.
Eugene Melnyk versus Pat Brisson. The Crosby controversy up next on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Ezra, Dave, and Drew return on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. No word if we're going to be joined by Mark Methot's finger or not, but boy, was that an ugly incident on Thursday night. Sidney Crosby with the, it's called the tap, and it happens, whether or not you know it, it happens in every NHL game, multiple times per game in every NHL game. This was an incident of the tap, and that's just when a player sort of taps another player on their gloves, on their stick, right around their
hands. It was more than a tap.
It was more than a tap, but it's happened a lot. You've seen a lot of incidents. There was a whole conversation earlier this season about should the tap be penalized.
With Johnny Gaudreau.
That's exactly right, with Johnny Gaudreau. And in this instance, Sidney Crosby's tap on Mark Methot of the Ottawa Senators caused Methot to lose, I don't know if he actually lost it, but significant damage.
No, he didn't lose his finger.
Well, he didn't lose his entire finger. Did he lose his tip of his finger, though?
Well, I don't think the finger actually came off. I think it was just the end of it was injured a little bit.
It was dangling pretty badly there. It was more than just injured, I would suggest.
It's funny.
Anyways,
let's get into this right
away.
Let's
hear from Eugene Melnyk.
Okay.
This is Ottawa Senators owner,
yep.
Eugene Melnyk.
Loves to talk.
Very entertaining. We always appreciate Eugene because he gives us content on the program. After the tap, after it was announced that Methot's going to be out for weeks, and then you and I, as you will talk about it. Here's Eugene Melnyk.
You know, you do anything that's almost a certain injury, and I think the only way to do it is you wipe the guy off the map for not one or two games, 10. How about a season for a few of these guys? You know, really, he takes my guy, I take your guy. And that's my attitude. The guy that creates the injury should be sitting out. You know, they should watch your games together for the rest of the season. You know, that's the kind of attitude I have. There's no room for that. And, you know, you got to think of it. Mark Methot, the guys, that's who you saw. I see the things behind the scenes of what happens with from slashes. And they're ugly. They're just as ugly as Mark's. But Mark's was so visible. You know, it was a terrifying thing that to look at those pictures. And, you know, I don't even want to think about it. It was that disgusting. So that's the only way to do it. You hammer these guys and you take away their money because they all understand money. And you simply say, you know what, you're done for 10 games. And guess what? You guys are not going to get even close to the Stanley Cup if it's an elite player on the other side. There's no room for it in the NHL. And we all know who he is. And the guy is just a whiner beyond belief. And, you know, you do this kind of stuff. I don't care who you are in the league. I don't care if you're the number one player in the league. You should sit out a long time for this kind of crap.
Eugene Melnyk calling Sidney Crosby a whiner. Pat Brisson, Crosby's agent, responded via, a text message or whatever to Darren Dreger. Quote, in my opinion, a team owner who makes a negative comment about a player outside of his organization should be fined for such action. It's worse than tampering and against the culture of our game. That's the quote from Pat Brisson about Eugene Melnyk's comments about Sidney Crosby.
Okay, first of all, who cares about Pat Brisson's comments? Let's talk about Eugene Melnyk's comments.
Pat Brisson's comments are hilarious. Talk about whining. I mean, if a guy's calling your player a whiner, you don't release a statement that sounds whiny. You do anything but that, in my opinion.
Where you need to go right now is Mike Johnson's Twitter account. Mike Johnson, former NHLer,
yeah.
Used to cover the Jets.
Yeah.
He posted.
It was a very good tweet.
A compilation of Mark Methot slashes on other players, and he slashes Alex Ovechkin in the clip. I believe he also slashes Hampus Lindholm in the clip.
Anthony Mantha.
Anthony Mantha is the first guy that they show. Mark Methot is a guy that slashes players all the time.
Happens in every game and never gets penalized because these aren't vicious hacks. These are taps. It's called the tap.
Yes, and then following that video that Mike Johnson posted, he said, I would punish the act and not the outcome. And really, that applies here, right? I mean, let's be honest. It was an accident. The slash wasn't that bad. Like, I'm sorry, I've watched it now probably half a dozen times. And I'm sure there are people out there that have watched it 100 times. Senators fans probably, who seem to on Twitter, have gone absolutely bananas over this. Like, guys, let's relax. It should have been a penalty. Like, when Eugene Melnyk starts talking about 10 games, like, are you serious?
I love Eugene Melnyk. He's great.
In this case, he's wrong.
He's completely out of his mind.
And by the way, you're calling a two-time Stanley Cup champion, a two-time Olympic gold medal winner, the best overall player in hockey right now. You're calling him a whiner.
It's not the first time that Sidney Crosby has been called a whiner.
I think it was disrespectful.
Oh, I certainly was disrespectful. There's no question about it that it was disrespectful. I mean, the whole thing is it's a play that happens multiple times in every single game. it's a bad outcome that everybody saw because the finger was just dangling there. The whole thing is, I mean, I love Eugene Melnyk because he gets to speak about it. Pat Brisson sounds whiny in response. I mean, he does sound whiny in response. How about Sidney Crosby just apologize? Maybe he did. Maybe he apologized behind the scenes. We don't know. But just say, you know, sorry, dude, my bad. You know, like you said, Mark Methot has done this so many times. He knows that Crosby's not trying to injure him in this instance. How about a simple apology and this whole thing goes to bed?
By the way, just quickly here, a lot of people are talking about if this was Mark Methot slashing Sidney Crosby and this happened to Sidney Crosby's finger, that Mark Methot would be getting five games. That's absolutely false.
Yeah.
I don't think that Mark Methot would get any games for that. I mean,
I saw a tweet earlier today.
It was a minor penalty drew that play. That's it.
I saw a tweet earlier in the day, and I don't remember who it was from, and they said that in terms of incidences that have occurred to Sidney Crosby in the course of his career, you know, if the NHL protects him so well.
He gets hacked all the time.
One player, Brandon Dubinsky, is the only player who's ever been suspended for perpetrating an act against Sidney Crosby.
It was an unfortunate event, right?
Yeah.
That happens. Hockey, I mean, you know, we've all played hockey. Sometimes you get, you know, slashed in the back of the leg, depending on where it is, where you don't have the padding.
Yeah.
I mean, things happen. And again, you know, we're not protecting Sidney Crosby or anything like that. I mean, like I said, it should have been a penalty. But to start saying that he's a dirty player or, he's a whiner or he should have got five games is ludicrous.
The five games is ludicrous. I agree with you there. Everything else I find to be thoroughly entertaining. An entertaining week for Sidney, of course, as he stuck Ryan O'Reilly in the nether regions earlier in the week.
And again, Drew, I agree with you. Eugene Melnyk is sticking up for his players,
yeah.
But I don't know if you necessarily have to do that through the media, but...
You know, Eugene Melnyk probably got a little carried away in everything but that everything was fair game up until that last comment. If he doesn't make the last comment about calling Sidney a whiner, then nobody really pays attention to this whole thing. It's when he called Crosby a whiner that it now is a topic of conversation. Let's head to break. Adrian Dater is going to join us next. Tomorrow is the 20-year anniversary of the famous Colorado Avalanche-Detroit Red Wings brawl at Joe Louis Arena.
Blood feud,
the brawl that ended with Patrick Waugh and Mike Vernon doing battle, and Waugh racing down the ice and Brendan Shanahan coming out to attack him 20 years ago.
You don't mess with little Mikey Vernon.
20 years ago tomorrow, we talked to Adrian Dater about it. He covered the feud more than anyone else. That's up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
On the Curve, on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Minutes before the top of the hour, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
As I mentioned before the break, tomorrow is 20 years since the brawl at Joe Louis Arena between the Detroit Red Wings and the Colorado Avalanche. Adrian Dater is with bsndenver.com. He's the author of Blood Feud, which is a book that chronicled the famous rivalry between the Red Wings and the Avalanche, all those famous playoff series. Adrian, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good morning.
Can you believe, Adrian, that's been 20 years since that game? What was it like that night being in Joe Louis Arena? I mean, you knew that you were watching two of the best teams in the NHL at that era. Did you get the feeling, before that game started, was there any hint in the air that this was going to be the vengeance game that where, Claude Lemieux would get his comeuppance for his hit on Chris Draper the previous playoffs?
I think there was some feeling, yes. Claude Lemieux, that game came in March, so a lot of people have asked over the years, why did it take till March for this stuff to happen against Lemieux? After all, the playoffs happened the previous May. when he injured Chris Draper's face and the famous hit and all that. They played three times, the Avalanche and Red Wings, before that game in March 97. Basically, Claude Lemieux was injured for the first two games, couldn't play. And the third game, though, the first game back that Lemieux was there for, the game against Detroit, was in Denver at the old McNichols Arena. And we all expected something to happen that day. For, you know, that was the game, first game back between him and the team. And the Red Wings did nothing. I mean, nothing. So we were all kind of stunned by that. But when we got to Detroit for the next time, the media there were sort of, and a lot of the rivalry was just, you know, putting myself out of it. The media played a role in this stuff, a big role. Day of the game, Bob Wojnarowski of the Detroit News wrote a column saying, basically, if the Red Wings don't get even for Lemieux tonight, they're going to be, you know, perhaps forever known as, you know, chickens, or the pretty, not gritty team. And don't forget, this team hadn't won a Stanley Cup yet. So there was a lot of agitation for them to do something back. The Detroit News that day had a thing on their front page saying, you know, they had Claude Lemieux's face in a mugshot, and it said wanted on it, and it listed all kinds of nefarious deeds Lemieux had committed over the years, in addition to the Draper thing. And so the feeling was that, yeah, if there was going to be a night to have this stuff happen, it was going to be that night. It's in Detroit. The Red Wings hadn't beat the Avs all year. They were 0-3 against the Avs after getting beat in the Western Finals. So it was all set up there for that to happen, but it's amazing when you look back at the coincidences that if all these coincidences in a game hadn't happened the way they did, there probably wouldn't have been an opportunity to really get from you like they did. And that leads on to other things. But to answer your question, yeah, I think there was an expectation, but for it to happen the way it did, nobody could have predicted that much.
Adrian, I'm not sure if you got to check out Chris Draper's Players Tribune article, but it was basically about that exact incident and the rivalry between the Detroit Red Wings and the Colorado Avalanche. When you consider it's been 20 years and Chris Draper in the article mentions that these teams legitimately despised each other, have we seen any rivalry come anywhere close to that rivalry between the Wings and Avalanche and just the hatred that they had for each other, both teams wanting to win the Stanley Cup?
No, I haven't. Not since then, no. Just, you know, there's been some heated playoff matchups, I think. You know, I think Dallas and Edmonton was a pretty good one for a while. You know, there's always going to be rivalries with some of the Eastern teams and Philly and Pittsburgh and stuff like that. But, no, I don't think I've ever seen anything ever, I mean, close to that since then. And, boy, I hope these things come back, because I really do think that the NHL has been hurt by this. The lack of rivalry, the lack of hatred, the lack of animosity, the lack of true Hatfield-McCoy kind of stuff. I mean, let's face it, that stuff is fun as a fan. It gets you involved as a fan. It's interesting from a media perspective, and I think it's been lost somewhat. I don't know what reason, when I suspect it's because the NHL has toned down its it's fighting, and it's any kind of hit that you make now, definitely goes right under the pruder film, as I like to call it, microscope, and punishments are dealt out, and people don't want to be suspended. So, but no, it really was just so much fun to be a part of it. But yeah, those two teams just, it was real. The word was true. They hated each other. I mean, the fans hated each other, the media hated each other, and the players hated each other. It's all wrapped up. That's what made it a great run. You don't get those three combinations all that often.
Adrian, I know over the years you've been to the Joe Louis Arena many times covering the Avalanche, this being the last year of the Joe Louis Arena. What's been going through your mind with all the memories there that have taken place between the Red Wings and the Avalanche?
Well, I was just at the Joe for the last game the Avalanche played last weekend for BSN Denver, covered it for them. And so it was a really, I didn't break down in tears or anything, but it was kind of an emotional day for me. Just being in that building and for the last time, it was just it all came flooding back for sure. Sitting in that press box and the arena really hasn't changed at all. I always liked the arena for the sight lines and just I thought it was a good arena. I mean, a lot of people dumped on it, but I always loved it. So I was there and it was definitely nostalgic and. Bit of a melancholy feeling for me, but time moves on, and they've needed a new building, I think. And that was the scene of so many of the bitter games, and it was definitely fun to be there for that last game. I took a lot of mementos, and I'll always be proud and honored to have stepped foot in that place. Cover those great games.
Adrian Dater is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're discussing the 20th anniversary of the Avalanche Red Wings brawl at Joe Louis Arena. That 20th anniversary is tomorrow. Adrian is with BSNDenver.com and the author of Blood Feud, the inside story of pro sports' nastiest and best rivalry of its era. Adrian, going back to that famous fight and that night at Joe Louis Arena, and you see, Patrick Waugh and the image of Patrick Waugh racing the length of the ice to try and save Claude Lemieux as he's being pummeled by Darren McCarty, and then Brendan Shanahan coming to meet Patrick Waugh and flying through the air. It's a vivid image for any hockey fan from the mid to late 90s. Did you get the impression that Patrick Waugh was itching for a fight that night? Did he want to be involved in that battle? I mean, so often these days, goaltenders, just skate away and they stay at their opposite ends and they let whatever happens, happens. Did you get the feeling that Patty wanted to be involved in knowing him and covering the team as you did? Did you get the feeling he was desperate to get involved there as well?
Well, I don't think he was in that instance because he was just, it all unfolded and he was more or less just by instinct coming out to support a teammate because there was nothing for him to really agitate for. The Avalanche were dominating Detroit at that time still, and even in that game, I mean, they were up 5-3. They'd beaten the Wings in the playoffs the year before. They'd beaten them three times during the regular season, pretty soundly too. I think the Avalanche would have loved to have just gotten in and gotten out of there with nothing, no incidents. I think they would have won another Stanley Cup if that had been the case. I'll tell you what Atwa was agitating for, though, was a fight during the next year when he challenged Chris Osgood at center ice. That was fight number two on the dance card that Waugh had with Detroit goalies over the years. There was he fought Vernon, he fought Osgood, and he tried to fight Dominic Hasek in 2002, but Hasek skated down to the ice, but he fell over his stick, and he tripped and fell, and the fight never really started. But the one against Osgood was a game in 98 where the Avalanche were definitely getting schooled by the Wings and beaten up and just dominated. Wanted to try and shake up his team just like Mike Vernon did for his team. If you read in the book, I talk about how Vernon was on the outs in Detroit at the time in 97. Before that game, he was bad-mouthed a lot by Wings fans that he couldn't win the big ones and, couldn't beat the Avalanche. And he was the one who was itching for the fight. He's the one who thought, aha, here's my chance to get not only some points for my team and do something against Colorado, show that I care and I'm a man of Detroit and I'm a blue-collar guy. Yeah, he needed to show the fans and get them off his back, and that's what he did. So Waugh was the one who was sort of the unwilling combatant in 97. In 98, he was the more than willing combatant. And not that Patrick ever shied away from any kind of stuff like that. He liked to fight in a way. He liked to get into it. He had a huge temper. But the one in Detroit was all the rings are the ones agitating for the fights there, and it helped turn the season around.
Adrian, we've got one last question for you here. Just getting away from the rivalry between the Wings and Avalanche, Jerome Iginla was announced as the Masterton Trophy nominee for the LA Kings by the LA Professional Hockey Writers Association. And the reason why he was named the nominee was basically because of his mentorship role with the Colorado Avalanche, all the young players there. Were you a little bit surprised that Iggy was named the nominee for the Masterton Trophy by the Kings?
Well, I guess I'm not surprised, but I guess I'm a little surprised if that was the full rationale of mentoring the players. Not that he was never around and didn't say plenty to young players, but I'm not sure that's probably not the rationale I may have given for that. I just think, you know, Iggy's a great role model and stuff, and just leads by example. I don't know if he was ever a guy that kids sat at their locker and his locker and heard from the wise man on the Sermon on the Mount kind of thing. In fairness to the media on these things, they got to name someone. You know, all 30 teams have to name a player. And, you got to pick someone. He usually goes to the oldest guy or the guy who's had the hardship somewhere.
Yeah.
Or a combination of the two. But, hey, good for Iggy. I hope he wins it. He's a definite class guy. Really enjoyed having him around in Colorado. I'll tell you what, he should have won the Masters, and just for being such a good quote for the media, just giving insight into the game to the media folk. But, I know that he was well-liked in the room. So good for him. Maybe there's more to that than I realized, but I would have thought it's just Iggy being Iggy, why you could name him.
Adrian Dater is with BSNDenver.com. His book is called Blood Feud, Detroit Red Wings versus Colorado Avalanche.
I got that for a birthday present about 10 years ago.
I'm sure you did.
I still own it.
It's a fantastic read if you want to look back at one of the great rivalries in 20th century sports, and truly right now the last great rivalry in the NHL. Adrian, appreciate your time this morning. 20 years, hard to believe. Thanks very much for joining us to talk about that great incident at Joe Louis Arena.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for your friend buying the book on the birthday. And
that was my dad, actually.
All the kind words, and I can't believe it. You're right. It's 20 years. How did that happen?
Where does the time go? It's true.
Time marches on. Thanks for having me, and hopefully we'll get another rivalry at some point.
Yeah, we'll do it again soon. Thanks very much, Adrian.
Okay.
Let's head to break. One final segment coming up. We talk about a very important charity event occurring tomorrow morning. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Now you're on the curve on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
One final segment this Saturday morning here on TSN 1290. It's brought to you by our good friends at Keener Jerseys. Keener Jerseys, known as one of the world's best jersey customizers. If you want awesome jerseys for your rec team or have a jersey you want personalized, visit Keener Jerseys online at keenerjerseys.com. You can check out their new showroom, 982 Portage Avenue. That's the corner of Portage and Sherburn. Tell them that Illegal Curve sent you. Keener Jerseys, best place for jerseys here in Peg City. Pleased to welcome to the studio good friend of ours, Aaron DeGroot. Aaron is involved in a charity event tomorrow morning occurring at the Assiniboine Park Duck Pond. The event is called Trek for Tourette, and it goes to raise money and raise awareness on Tourette syndrome. Is that correct, Aaron?
That is absolutely correct. This is the 9th annual Trek for Tourette here in Winnipeg, and very excited to be here. Thanks so much for having me. And it's a cause that I love talking about because it's near and dear to my heart. My wife and I have been involved in this now for 5 or 6 years, and it's a fantastic event, and it's a great way to raise awareness for Tourette syndrome.
So, Aaron, we're going to be there tomorrow. I was there last year. participating, walking very slowly, I must say,
yeah.
in
yes.
the 5 kilometer yeah. walk. For those people who haven't participated in this before and who are thinking about coming out tomorrow, can you just let everybody know what it's all about?
Yeah, absolutely. So the whole point, like I said, is to raise awareness for Tourette's syndrome. We'll be meeting at 9 a.m. at the Duck Pond at Assiniboine Park is registration, and the event starts at 10 a.m. It's a 5 kilometer walk or run. As you are our esteemed celebrity guest this year, along with Mandy Hsu from your sister station at Virgin.
Yeah, Mandy is one in terms of this. If we have to rank the celebrity guests, all due respect to my colleague here, Ezzy, Mandy, and then Ezzy way down.
Oh, yeah, it's not even close.
It's not close. She can run 5 kilometers. Yeah. You can wheeze through maybe a kilometer and a half.
Like, you know when they say, like, D celebrity?
Yeah.
Like, I'm a D celebrity. Yeah. Mandy Hsu's an A celebrity.
Yeah, clearly, I would agree with that entirely. That's the smartest thing you've said on the show all day today.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm thinking we have you guys race to determine this once and for all, who is the... who's in the best shape? And
me versus Ezzy?
Well, and Drew, if you're free, come on out. But I was thinking Mandy versus Ezzy. We can have a...
Mandy will kill me. She's always in different runs and walks and stuff like that.
Sweat when she eats and all those things that generally are a sign of a person who's not altogether unhealthy.
Aaron, the only problem is if Drew and I have a race at the Trek for Tourette, neither of us is actually going to finish. We're both actually just going to collapse on the side of the road.
Yeah.
So there's not actually going to be a winner.
You're just going to feed us to the animals at the zoo is what happens at that point in time if Ezzy and I were to have a race. So Aaron, you mentioned that it's the 9th annual Trek for Tourette tomorrow at the Assiniboine Park Duck Pond. Registration 9 a.m. The walk begins at 10 a.m. and it's the fifth year that you and your wife have been involved in this great event. Why is it so important to you guys? You're both very busy people. You have a young child. You're obviously making time to participate in this event and to come here and talk about it. So why is this event so near and dear to both you and your wife?
Yeah, absolutely. So my wife is an occupational therapist, and very early on in her career, she got involved with the Tourette Syndrome Clinic at the St. Boniface Hospital. And, and through working with them, she got hooked up with the Tourette Syndrome Foundation of Canada and just started volunteering and doing everything we could to raise awareness. I think what really drew us to it was the people that were involved and getting to see the kids and what they battle with on a daily basis. The stigma involved, you can picture a 7 or 8 year old kid in elementary school and the bullying and isolation that may come along with somebody who's maybe presenting a little differently than everybody else. And it ties into mental health awareness. We all know about Bell Let's Talk and, the awareness that tries to raise. And this is really tied into that because people with Tourette's syndrome, they typically have, what we call comorbidities. Includes anxiety, ADHD, OCD, autism, learning disabilities. So this really ties into, the age of mental health awareness and really getting the word out. And Tourette syndrome is not, not something that we think about on a daily basis, but these people live with it every day and they struggle. So anything that we can do to raise more money, raise awareness, help these people out, specifically the children that are affected by it and the things they go through on a daily basis. It's something we really wanted to help out with, and we stay involved to this day, and we will for years to come.
Aaron, for those people that are interested in coming out tomorrow, what's the best way they can do that? Should they register online or should they just show up tomorrow?
Yeah, where can they find more information about it at all?
Yeah, so the website is www.tourette.ca. Tourette is TOURETTE.ca. There's a page there to register for the event. If you forget to do that, it's fine. Come on out. Register at 9 a.m. You consider making a donation to the cause. We would really appreciate that, and it's a lot of fun. We usually get a few hundred people out there. Like I said, Ezzy's going to be out there as our esteemed celebrity guest. We're serving lunch, and the weather's starting to turn, so it's going to be a real nice day for a walk. The reason we do this in March is because the weather is very unpredictable. Just like the disorder, it can be a very unpredictable thing. So, it's kind of fun to get out there in March, start the spring off, and come enjoy some time at Assiniboine Park.
You mentioned the weather. It's supposed to be +8 tomorrow. I remember last year it was probably like -5 or -10. So it's definitely going to be a lot more fun walking in the warmer temps.
For sure. We're really, really excited about it.
Aaron DeGroot, appreciate you joining us here in studio to talk about the Trek for Tourette taking place tomorrow morning. Registration 9 a.m., walk at 10 a.m., meet at the Duck Pond at Assiniboine Park. That's it for the Saturday edition of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Big thank you to all of our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Zappia Group Realty, Bernstein's Deli, Linden Market Dental Center, and Keener Jerseys. Support those fine businesses because they support the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news is IllegalCurve.com. Big props to producer Rory, doing a great job behind the board. For Ezra Ginsberg, for Aaron DeGroot, I'm your host, Drew Mindell.
Go Kentucky.
Go Kentucky, exactly right. Big game against UNC tomorrow. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.